Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely per House Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll. Ms. Borgerding, please proceed.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen. Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Okay, we have a quorum present. First, we will move to approval of the minutes from February 16th. Representative Feist, do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Feist moves the minutes. Any discussion? Representative Johnson.
I had technical difficulties. I couldn't announce that I was here.
Okay. All right. So the clerk will note that Representative Johnson is present. Any further discussion to the minutes? Representative Mortensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I never heard my name on roll call either, so I just want to make sure that everybody knows I'm here.
All right. Noted. Any discussion to the minutes? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are adopted, and I just got to note that Representative Herr is here as well. So I think we are all here and accounted for. The minutes of February 16th, 2021 are approved. We've got four bills on the agenda today, so we will get right to it. The first bill on the agenda is House File 59. It's a Representative Elkins bill. I will move that House File 59 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. We now have the bill in front of us. Representative Elkins, please tell us about your bill.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to share my screen real quick here. And, yep, so this bill is a trio bills with deals with health care pricing transparency, the other two being Health File 57 and 58. And in each, you know, the basic premise for all three bills is the fact that we encourage health plans and employers to offer high deductible health plans with health savings account in the belief that if patients have to pay more out of pocket for their health care, they'll be incentivized to become better shoppers for more cost-effective health care. The problem is that we then deny them the price information that they need to become better shoppers. And the purpose of these three bills is to provide them with this price information. So in the big picture, 57 provides list price information building upon a federal rule that already requires hospitals to post their list prices, their self-pay rates, and their average and median and minimum maximum reimbursement rates on their websites. 58 builds on Representative Morrison's bill, which became last year and requires drug manufacturers to reveal their list prices. 59 allows the Minnesota Department of Health to make improvements to the all payer claims database, and then allows them to use it to reveal what prices are actually being paid in the marketplace. So it complements the information about list prices that would be provided by 57 and 58. So in isolation, each one of these bills only provides a small piece of the puzzle. Collectively, they provide a pretty comprehensive view to consumers about what healthcare prices and drugs are going to cost. So the All Payers Claims Database is a repository of health care claims data records that are submitted to the department.
Representative Elkins, I'm actually going to stop you right there. I don't know if you have something else playing in the background, but we're getting a little bit of an audio feedback. I just want to make sure we're able to fully pay attention to your presentation.
I think that's better. I think I had another.
That's better. Please go ahead, Representative Elkins.
Okay, thank you. No, I'm supposed to be in state government finance at the same time, so that one was on my cell phone. Sorry about that. So the All Payer Claims Database is a repository of health care claims records submitted to the Department of Health by Minnesota Health Plans. Many states have All Payer Claims Databases. They're promoted under federal law, and many states have them. Their purpose is to support medical research and reporting. And the usage of the Minnesota All Payer Claims Database is limited right now because under our current state law, only semi-annual submissions are required from the health plans. And so much of the data in the database currently is stale by the time it's used for analysis. And some plan administrators withhold the data from employer-financed ERISA plans, so the scope of the data is incomplete. So the APCD data cannot currently be used for price reporting because of earlier negative experiences with using this stale, incomplete data for this purpose. It was a program called the Provider Peer Group Reporting. And the negative feedback was such that a provision was put into state law that prohibits its use for that purpose. So the objectives of the bill itself are to improve the latency of the data by requiring monthly submissions from everyone. And most health plans actually are reporting the data monthly. It's actually easier to do that because then you get more manageable data volumes of data as bite-sized chunks instead of a huge volume of records to transmit twice a year. And it leverages languages that was just passed in the Federal No Surprises Act, which encourages the submission of ERISA plan data to improve the scope of the data. And I have also been working with representatives of the Minnesota Business Partnership and the Chamber of Commerce, to help, enlist their support and encouraging their members to have their plan administrators submit their data. The bill allows the improved data to be used for reporting of actual price data by procedure and provider. So we can't report by provider and health plan as well because that's prohibited by federal law in order to protect the confidentiality of the negotiated rates. So as I mentioned before, it supplements the reporting of published price data required by H 57 to 58. And noteworthy is that in the No Surprises Act, Congress has appropriated a grant of $2.5 million per state to fund these types of initiatives with some strings attached, including a provision that the states have to work on developing procedure for making the data available with very strict guidelines to outside researchers as well. We're here probably in this committee primarily to discuss the data privacy implications. So members of this committee should know that the claims information that the plans submit to the All Payer Claims Database is all de-identified. It includes no personally identifiable information. So names, addresses, identification numbers for plan identification numbers are all stripped out before the data is sent to the Department of Health. And the database itself includes very limited information and only information that's relevant for healthcare research that could potentially be used to re-identify the records. So it does include gender and includes age, but significantly not date of birth. And it includes 5-digit zip codes, though only the first 3 are ever revealed in any kind of public reporting. And that's important because studies have shown is that if you have gender, you have the exact birth date, you have a 5-digit zip code, it's not that hard to use other publicly available sources to re-identify the person that the record belongs to. And also worthy mention that none of those 3 attributes would be exposed in any pricing reporting because for price reporting, the 3 of them are irrelevant. They're only there to support medical research. And we have with us to answer questions today, if necessary, Stefan Gildemeister, the state healthcare economist at MDH, who's the expert on this database. I've spoken with Stefan MDH knows how to address the patient practice granularity issues. And this was an issue that was quite validly raised by Representative Lucero in the Commerce Committee hearing. And it's much more common in a problem in educational data. But the scenario is that you've got a small practice in a small town. Everybody in town perhaps knows that a particular person in the town has a particular condition. Potentially, if you're reporting on the price of a procedure by practice, someone could be able to tell just from the fact that, oh, the only person in the town who's getting this procedure done would be so-and-so. Stefan has assured me, and you've explained to me how they're aware of this issue and are already addressing it in the way they use the data, and then also that the APCD database is very strongly secured against hackers. And Mr. Gildemeister is prepared to discuss that as well as it comes up. So I think we do have a couple of testifiers. This probably would be a good time to hear from them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. If you could stop sharing your screen so we can fully see the testifiers, that would be helpful. First on the list, I have Dave Renner. Mr. Renner, if you could introduce yourself and give your name and title for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dave Renner. I'm here representing the Minnesota Medical Association. We are an association representing physicians and physicians in training, about 10,000 members statewide. First, I want to say the MMA has strongly supported and continues to support the all-payer claim database because the APCD does offer unique ability to capture claims across all payers, allows the State Department of Health to do analysis of that data and then to help that with quality improvement and other research projects. Access to this data has always, to any kind of data, has always been a way to better and improve care and services that physicians and others provide. The Department of Health has used the APC data to report on chronic disease trends, pharmaceutical spending, use and price variations in certain medical conditions, frequency of low-valued services, and others. That said, the APC does have limitations, and that must guide its future use. The data that it developed or that are submitted currently are not timely enough, and Representative Elkins' bill tries to address that. We appreciate that. Nor is the data, we believe, timely or granular enough to really support purchasing decisions, and I think that's where we may have disagreement with the chief author. So the MMA strongly supports Section 4 of this bill, and Representative Elkins, I appreciate the work he's doing to say we want the commissioner to look at what are additional uses we can use the APCD for. Let's come back with some recommendations on how we do that. We think that's important. However, we have real concerns with Section 3 of the bill because prior to those recommendations coming back, this bill would basically say the department can now start releasing identifying data on hospitals, clinics, and other providers. That change, we believe, will come with risk, both in the confidence and the trust of the APCD, but also the reputation of individual physicians and other healthcare providers if that data is not accurate or reliable or valid. What we would ask, and we've been talking with the author and we will continue to talk and work with him, is that the Section 2 be deleted of the bill and instead Section 4 be amended to include, as the commissioner comes back with recommendations, that the commissioner would also come back with recommendations related to how and under what circumstances data should be appropriately released that identifies providers and others. Madam Chair, I appreciate the chance to raise these concerns. We hope to continue to work with the author and address this, but I think we really would be careful because we are shifting from a program that historically or that has been used for quality improvement and data report and research projects to a price comparison tool, and we don't think that the data is ready to be done to be used that way at this point. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Renner. We do have one other testifier who signed up ahead of time. I do want to get to them, and then we can go to member questions. I believe we have Ashley Smothers here. If you want to introduce yourself for the record, and then please go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ashley Smothers, and I am the Legislative and Policy Manager at Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I am here to speak on behalf of Twyla Braze, our president, about this bill. CCHF has long been opposed to the all-payer claims database. I will mention five specific concerns about this bill. First, House File 59, as we've discussed at length with Representative Elkins, expands the purposes and the uses of this controversial government database, all without patient consent. Second, a national all-payer claims database is being knit together using $2.5 million per state in federal dollars. The money given to states willing to link their state's all-payer database together with other state all-payer databases will enable free-flowing access to data between states. This means people, corporations, governments, and researchers outside Minnesota will gain access for purposes patients have not consented to and may cause harm or limit choices. In 2012, nearly 183 million claims were submitted to the database. In 2016, 89% of all patient encounters, 1.5 billion, were in the database. How many patient encounters are in Minnesota's database today? If this bill passes, it will be available to countless outsiders. Third, HF 59 adds the names of individual practitioners and facilities to the database, allowing outsiders to use the data to make incomplete assessments and inaccurate claims from outside the exam room about what happened inside the exam room. This analysis and surveillance of private patient encounters is unethical and unconstitutional, and it will dangerously focus the doctors and hospitals' attentions on how data should look and not on what the patient needs. Fourth, the new federal all-payer database law allows research without patient consent, although the use of an institutional review board may sometimes be required. But insurers, employers, third-party administrators, and healthcare providers will be allowed to receive access by simply describing the intended uses for such data, as long as they claim it's for quality improvement or cost containment, terms that can mean almost anything. We believe this research provision, along with the state-to-state sharing, will be used to skirt Minnesota's protective privacy law. Unlike HIPAA, the Minnesota Health Records Act requires patient consent for most data sharing, including for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations, a very broad term which includes conducting quality assessment and improving activities, and activities relating to improving health or reducing healthcare costs. Thus, we believe HF 59 would enable violation of Minnesota's medical privacy law. Fifth, any requirement of the federal's law research provisions can be waived by the secretary. And although a data use and confidentiality agreement must prohibit re-identification enforcement, and penalties are not clear. Importantly, the greatest danger for most patients will not be privacy. It will be the imposition of outside controls on the provision of care. Ultimately, privacy protects doctor freedom and patient choices. In other words, he who holds the data makes the rules. A 2016 survey of more than 17,000 physicians found nearly 50% of them looking for an exit, targeting physicians by name and using patient data to restrict the doctor's ability to follow the medical ethics of personalized care will mean fewer physicians, longer waits for appointments, and protocol-based treatment rather than personalized care. Thus, we oppose House File 59. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate you listening.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Smothers. We will move to member discussion. First on the list, I have Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have some questions. And I don't know if this is to Representative Elkins. It might be to the person from the Department of Health regarding the more specifics about the database and MDH's use of it. And I'm just curious, for starters, how many people or patient encounters are registered currently in Minnesota's all-payer claims database, if he knows the answer to that question.
Yeah, I think
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I think that would be a better question for Mr. Gildemeister to answer.
All right. Mr. Gildemeister, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the health economics program at the Department of Health. And in that role, I am responsible for the maintenance and use of the Minnesota APCD. That puts me at a little bit of an arm's length distance from the actual data, of course, which means I rather look up the answer to Representative Scott's question so I don't have the actual number in front of me. But maybe to give you context, sort of the the payers included in the data and required under state law to submit it are private payers' data through Medicare and through state public programs. So that data is in the database. We don't have information on the from the Veterans Administration, other federal data sources, and we don't have sort of a means to collect data on the uninsured. So there are limits of the information that comes through, and of course the data is de-identified, so we don't know who is in the data. So I apologize for not having the answer.
Yeah, that's okay. We would prefer to have accurate information. If you don't have it, we can always get that to committee members afterwards. Representative Scott, follow up.
Thank you. And it's Mr. Gildermeister. I believe I have that last name right. It cuts off after Gildem. So on the screen, I'm wondering what data elements are collected into the all payer claims database. And then another question would be, for research purposes and so forth, which is what a lot of this data is being used for, and correct me if I'm not right, but the Minnesota Health Records Act says that a person should be able to opt in or out of having their information used for research. Whether that's de-identified or not, to me, that is an important point. And so my questions are twofold. What data sets are collected into this all payer claims database? And secondly, is there any way that a person, a patient, can opt out of having their encounters with their physicians? Is there a way for them to opt out of that?
Mr. Gildermeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, thank you for those two questions. So the data in the database generally is what we think of as transaction records for healthcare. So that includes de-identified elements that sort of roughly describe patients, the age at the time of the encounter, the patient sex, the zip code at which the patient lives. Then there are data elements related to the diagnosis that sort of provides the ability to understand for which condition treatment was provided. And then there are data elements related to the procedure that was delivered. The data also includes information on the servicing and billing provider, as well as who the health insurance payer was. As I noted before, data comes from Medicare, from Medicaid, and commercial payers. But I think what I also want to leave you with is sort of an understanding what's not in the data. So no patient name, no date of birth, no social security number. We don't collect the address. We don't have test results from labs. There's no information on race, ethnicity, or income, and sort of typical clinical data that is in electronic medical records are also not part of the database. To your second question, it's a tricky one, Representative Scott. So the data are de-identified before they even come to MDH. So we don't have a mechanism, we don't have a means to give patient the ability to be excluded from the data. So that is how the legislature had set it up, to have the data de-identified before they come to MDH, and thereby sort of severely reduce the risk to individuals for their data to be misused.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I know, I guess it's just one other person has questions, but I mean, I have so many questions about this. My main concern is that this data is going to be used for research, and they're going to start, first of all, it's a limited set of data, which is good in one side, on one hand, because we don't want personally identifying information to be going to this database. And it looks like, you know, there's a carrot approach for states to join this database, and then you're interconnected with with other states. And so it just goes out and out and out from there. But my one of my other concerns is that this is going to be used as a hammer on providers, on doctors and clinics and hospitals to provide only this kind of care if it's this diagnosis. And it takes away that relation, that doctor-patient relationship to tailor make a treatment for that specific patient. And so that is, I have multiple concerns with this issue, but that at the end is what I think this is going to be used for, is just to say, if you've got this kind of cancer, it's at this stage, this is your only option. And oh, doctor, if you don't use this protocol, yeah, you're going to be, now your information is going to be public, and you may not have certain reimbursements from the federal government or from the state government, or you may be penalized in some other way, because this does not address any penalties at all, or how they could be used against providers. So, I mean, I have like five other questions, but I will let the committee go on and ask, maybe some other members have some questions as well. Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to ask my questions. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Scott. And I will note too that we're sending this to Chair Liebling's committee next, and I know that she has always paid careful attention to these issues as well. Mr. Gildemeister, did you have a quick follow-up? We've got three other members who want to ask questions.
Madam Chair, thank you for that. I just wanted to offer to Representative Scott maybe to reach out to us and help her address her concerns. I think there were some misunderstandings related to how this bill links up to national data. It's not my understanding that that is going to happen at all. This bill doesn't do anything about that. And I want to be clear to say that the Health Department is not taking a position on the bill. So I'm just clarifying for the record. I think the other point I wanted to note is the legislature is the body who will address how the data will be used, whether in partnership with other states or the federal government. So I don't think the path towards national data, where Minnesota data are linked up, is at all one that has been decided on.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. Representative Johnson is next.
Chair Becker-Finn, members, I just have a couple quick comments. First of all, our own house research has brought up some concerns with this bill. When asked some questions, one of the comments we got back from them is this bill would allow studies to be published in a manner that may identify individual hospitals, clinics, or providers. It would also allow the commissioner to release summary data to the public that may also identify individual payers and providers. That is a concern because we want to make sure that things are private. Now, in the metro area, you have a huge population. So identifying a person by an individual hospital or a clinic is not an issue. Now, you get out to greater Minnesota and the greatest part of Minnesota, it's a little different. We're smaller communities. We know everybody. And when this information gets out, we're going to know who had what and what was going on. If somebody wants to snoop and look at that data, and especially when the commissioner has the ability to publish it to the public. So I have a lot of concerns about that. And then as the last testifier stated, this particular bill doesn't share that information, but there's two other bills that this go along with. We need to look at not only this bill, all three of them, how they intertwine, because what we're doing in this bill might not allow that data to be shared, but the other bills will because of this bill. So we have to look at the whole totality of all three bills in one, and I just found out that these were hooked up to the other two bills with the information that was handed out earlier this morning by Ms. Gambini. The other issue is one of the statements made at the beginning talked about trying to force people into health savings account and keeping these high deductibles. Up until the ACA Act was passed, Minnesota had the lowest deductibles in the country, and we also had low insurance rates. The lower middle class and middle class and lower income people in the state are suffering because of these high deductibles. They might have health insurance, but they can't afford the deductible to go in to get checked out. They can't afford the health savings account because they just don't have the income to do that. Because right now they might not even have a job to put into a health savings account. So we really need to take a look at this. And because of those concerns, I cannot support this bill at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Moving on to Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And boy, I actually really agree with Representative Johnson on that one. I'd love to get rid of the deductibles, the out-of-pockets. This is a terrible problem. We shouldn't have them. But I originally raised my hand to respond to a bit to Representative Scott, because who was worried about the control of treatments that happen between doctors and patients. Boy, that horse left the barn a long time ago, Representative Scott. Most people don't pay for their own treatments. I mean, except for this deductible problem, which is what Representative Elkins is somewhat trying to get at here. You know, we got insurance companies, they control stuff. I mean, if you want to get rid of insurance companies, I'm right with you on that one, because we have the most messed up system. It's totally messed up. But we pay billions of dollars as a state for healthcare. Private payers, we're even paying for reinsurance. We're even supporting insurance companies to help them pay for the high costs that should be on them. I mean, this thing is so twisted and crazy. And the APCD is one attempt to try to get our arms around some of this. And boy, it's not a perfect attempt. And I would love it if we didn't have to do this kind of stuff. But unfortunately, we do. And, you know, I'm very concerned for patient privacy, as everybody knows. And I totally support the Minnesota Health Records Act. I'm sure, along with Representative Scott, we really share that in common, and we've worked hard to maintain that. However, this is not about individual patient privacy. And honestly, I'm less worried about the privacy of hospitals, clinics, and providers in terms of what they're charging. I mean, if we expect patients to shop for care, which is something that I do hear Republicans often in my committee talking about, people should be able to shop for the best price. Well, how the heck do you do that? I mean, the prices are all over the place. So if we want to give everybody privacy on their prices, forget about any kind of shopping. I mean, so we got to kind of decide, are we fish or fowl here? And frankly, you know, I'd rather get rid of the whole system. Everybody knows, I think we should have one payment system for healthcare and let the providers be independent and, you know, not controlled by government, but have one payer system. But we don't have that. We're not getting to that anytime soon. And so if we have this other system, there has to be some ability for people to find out what, you know, I mean, are there, at least I would think that it would be helpful for people to be able to find out what they're going to pay and where, you know, who's charging what. That does seem kind of logical to me. So we'll be looking closely at this bill. As the chair said, it'll be going to my committee. But I just think that it's in healthcare, it's so complicated. It's easy to be against everything, but sometimes you also have to be for something to make some things work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. We have Representative Robbins. You are next. I know Representative Scott, you have your hand up as well, but we do have quite a few other bills on the agenda, and we're trying to get everybody to have one shot at speaking first. So Representative Robbins, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I know you and I have had many conversations about price transparency. I am with you on that goal, but referring back to something that Mr. Renner said, because I really care about finding a way for patients to have proper data to shop, to understand, I think the market will help reduce costs and empower patients, and I really care about this. but Mr. Renner said that currently the data is, quote, not, I'm taking from my notes here, so hopefully I'm recalling it correctly, not accurate, reliable, or valuable for consumer shopping. And also he said the data was not ready to be a comparison tool. So yeah. If what you're doing here does not enable the data to really be useful for that, it worries me that the public will have sort of incomplete information, which is possibly more harmful in making healthcare choices. So maybe for you, Steve, yeah. or sorry, Representative Elkins or Mr. Renner, what data actually would be useful to consumers yeah. and how do we get to that point?
Yeah, Madam Chair, may I respond?
Representative Elkins.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins, yes. So again, the reason why the data is, it cannot by law be used for this purpose right now is that historically it has not been timely or comprehensive. But, you know, since that time, you know, well, there's the Medicare data has been added in that wasn't there before, but the bill itself says, we want the plans to report monthly. Some of them are only reporting twice a year, which means that the data currently is stale. So the first objective is the bill is to get the data so that it's consistently timely and much more comprehensive. And this is where also working with the business community through the chamber and the business partnership to make sure that their ERISA plan data is being contributed as well is an important part of the overall plan. And to Mr. Renner's comments, I committed to Mr. Renner that I would add language at the end of section three, this analogous to the language in section four that would say, yes, we're not going to use the data for this purpose until we are confident that in fact the data is suitable for this purpose, that we have accomplished our objectives in terms of improving the timeliness and comprehensiveness of the data. I think that's a perfectly reasonable request on the part of the MMA, and I'm committed to drafting an amendment that would be heard in when the bill gets to help the finance policy to accomplish that objective. So I think that is a very valid objective, one that I'm committed to addressing.
And members, we will move on to the vote. I do know Representative Elkins, I'm sure, will be happy to discuss yeah. things more in depth with folks offline if they have individual concerns they want to get into deeper with Representative Elkins. And so with that, I will renew my motion that House File 59 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Ms. Borgerding, please go ahead with the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Feis?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang? I have 9 ayes, 7 nays, and 1 excusal or abstention.
All right. And with that, the motion prevails. House File 59 is on its way to Health, Finance, and Policy. We'll get right to the next bill. Thank you, Representative Elkins and testifiers. The next bill on the agenda is House File 334. It's a Representative Frederick bill regarding OSHA data. I will move that House File 334 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Frederick, welcome to our committee. Please introduce your, or please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Luke Frederick. I'm here to introduce House File 334. It does 4 things. First piece is that it brings legislative changes to our apprenticeship program and just brings it in line with the federal guidelines. Second piece is it makes it so Menosha citation data can get published on the state website. Currently, it gets published in the workplace, and it also gets published on the national OSHA webpage. So now that with this, it would take already public data and simply put it on the Minnesota side as well. Third piece is it adds two members to the Construction Codes Advisory Council. Currently, the energy efficiency industry and disability community are not represented as well as they could be, and so it adds those two members. And then the fourth piece is that it takes what I'm going to call a loophole in current law and kind of closes it, where currently data pertaining to minors can get released publicly, and so it would just take an effort to try to protect data pertaining to minors.
All right. Thank you, Representative Frederick. I know we have an A1 author's amendment, so I will move the A1 amendment. My understanding is that it just removes some redundant language that needs to be cleaned up. All those in any discussion to the A1? All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Frederick, would you like us to go to your testifiers?
Yes, please.
All right. First on the list, I have Commissioner Robertson. Commissioner, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Rosalyn Robertson. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. As I understand, and thank you, Representative Frederick, for carrying the bill and introducing it in this committee. As I understand it, there are only two of the provisions included in the agency policy bill falls under the jurisdiction of this committee, and therefore I'll focus my attention on those two today. I'll begin with the child labor data protection. DLI is proposing that certain data about minors in child labor matters be deemed private or not public. Data as defined in Minnesota Statute 13.02, Subdivision 12. The agency found that there is no current protection of a minor's personal data retained by the Department of Labor and Industry for child labor exemption permit application work. It receives or related permits it issues for the data obtained related to child labor investigations. As a result, a minor's name and personal contact information is not redacted from materials if a data request is made. The purpose of this legislative change is to safeguard all minors who enter the workplace in Minnesota by preventing their personal contact information from being released upon an information request. The second provision is to improve the transparency of Minnesota OSHA citations. As Representative Frederick indicated, currently when citations are issued, an employer is required to post those citations in the workplace. And also when citations are issued, that information is communicated to federal OSHA, who also post the information on their website. Labor and Industry proposes legislation that will classify Minnesota OSHA citations as public as soon as Minnesota OSHA receives confirmation that the employer has received their citations in the mail. The proposal would allow Minnesota OSHA to provide timely information to the public and its stakeholders about its enforcement actions, which we believe would encourage employers to take necessary steps to keep their employees safe. Additionally, as Representative Frederick indicate, this would align Minnesota OSHA with the majority, the vast majority of state plan programs, as well as with federal OSHA. Those are our two provisions, and I would be happy to address any questions from the committee.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. We've got several other testifiers today, so we'll get through testimony and then take questions from members. Next on the list, I have Adam Dunick. Mr. Dunick, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Adam Dunick. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. We represent over 12,000 members who are carpenters, floor covers, lathers, millwrights, pile drivers, and industrial workers. As a union, we are dedicated to protecting and elevating the economic and social condition of all workers. We work and partner with our contractors to provide our industry with the best trained, most productive, and safest workforce available. And I'm here this morning to speak to the OSHA provisions of House File 334 and make the case for why it is good public policy. To us, Minnesota is an outlier when it comes to making public the safety violations of contractors and subcontractors. I represent carpenters and skilled crafts across six states, Nebraska, Iowa, South and North Dakota, Wisconsin, as well as Minnesota. And currently, Minnesota is the only state that does not make public their OSHA citations. In the construction industry, it is very common for subcontractors to employ a business model that cuts corners on how they pay their workers and how safely safety protocols are followed or not followed. We see this every day in the wood frame and drywall portion of construction, as well as other phases of work in residential and light commercial construction. And as an organization with a lot of credibility on these issues, we're frequently asked about which contractors and subcontractors have a track record of safety violations. We applaud the Department of Labor's efforts here to be more transparent about the OSHA citations. Not everyone agrees with this approach, of course, and to be clear, there are the same contractors and subcontractors who oppose this bill also routinely oppose policies related to wage theft, workers' compensation, and other safety policies that protect workers. They're out of step with the construction industry professionals that we work with. I'm making this point because within the construction sector, there are industry norms that all legitimate businesses follow and our skilled professionals that our union trains aspire to. We think it's important for our state to be leaders when it comes to track records of safety, and we believe this bill will help hold accountable the contractors and subcontractors who cut corners while also maintaining a fair and level playing field for the businesses that do the right thing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Dunick. Next, I have Stephanie Menning. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. Ms. Ghanani, can you clarify whether we have Ms. Menning in the Zoom room? All right, we'll go to the next testifier. Okay, Ms. Menning, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair and representatives, my name is Stephanie Menning. I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association, or MUCA. I represent over 135 utility contractor and vendor companies in Minnesota and their thousands of employees. The members of MUCA are responsible for construction of our critical underground infrastructure that Minnesotans enjoy every day, like clean water, sewer and wastewater infrastructure, gas, electric, and other utilities. On behalf of the members of MUCA, I am here to express our deep concern and opposition to House File 334, in its attempt to publish perceived OSHA citations at the time of issuance. Publication of issued citations does not take into consideration any due process, including the ability of the accused to face their accuser prior to any determinations being made public. Building a good business reputation takes years and even generations. Many MUCA members have been in business for several decades in an industry that is inherently dangerous. Safety of their workers is the centerpiece of their culture, as if they are family, and many of them are. Dad is the owner, the son is operating the backhoe, and the nephew is in the ditch. They're concerned that this may unjustly tarnish their lifelong established reputations in an instant. I would ask the committee to consider Minnesota's Ban the Box Law, where an employer is prohibited from asking a potential hire about their criminal record until after they want to extend an offer of employment. Conversely, this bill seeks to publish an employer's guilt before they have had an opportunity to ensure any published data is valid and not in a contested status, voided, or perhaps thrown out after a thorough investigation. While the commissioner's stated intention of this language is to encourage other employers to comply, we haven't seen any government data from other states proving that this tactic results in increased compliance. All we seek is an opportunity for redress prior to publication. Justice requires an opportunity for the accused to face their accuser before the citation is definitively ruled as an actual violation. Thank you for your time today, and I'll take any questions.
All right. Next on the list is Adam Hansen. Adam, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota and North Dakota. Our contractor members and the men and women they employ are part of the 80% of the construction industry in this state that choose to be marriage shop craft professionals. They build our schools, our medical facilities, restaurant and retail establishment, multi-housing, clean energy projects like solar and wind, and much more. Some of our contractors have registered apprenticeship programs through the Department of Labor and Industry, some of them through the Department of Labor at the federal level, and others have customized and unique training programs built around their particular line of work. ABC also has an industry-leading partnership with MnOSHA dating back to 2004 that is centered around a culture of safety, reducing workplace injuries, illness, and fatalities, as well as to continue the positive relationship between MnOSHA, ABC, and our contractor members. The partnership has been a great success, with many of our general contractor members and their subcontractors year after year choosing to continue to enter their new projects into the Compliance Partnership Program. I'm testifying today, however, in opposition to Section 5 of the bill related to classification of OSHA citation data, and that begins on line 2.26. As you heard before, current law and practice already make OSHA citation records timely and readily available through Federal OSHA's public website. Anyone can search the site for citation and list it by employer, project zip code, date range, and much more. From there, any member of the public can see if an investigation is open or closed, the type of penalty or fine that may have been issued, as well as the union affiliation or lack thereof for the contractor at issue. Current Minnesota law requires a contractor subject to a citation to post that citation for at least 20 days on the job site at or near where the alleged violation occurred. One clause of this section of the bill, however, would make public the description of the nature of the violation. This level of detail is not currently made public by federal OSHA, and it's unclear why it's needed here, especially given what is currently made public about the citation and required to be posted at the construction sites for employees to see already. The immediate publicizing of all details related to a citation would create an appearance of guilty until proven innocent for the named contractor. There are many times when a citation is issued and the contractor raises an affirmative defense or appeals the citation. When that happens and the contractor is successful in the appeal, penalties and fines may be reduced or not even levied at all. But if this section of the bill is enacted, I can absolutely envision scenarios when certain stakeholders take that detailed, publicly available citation data and engage in smear campaigns against contractors, even if the allegations in the citation aren't formally adjudicated at that point in time or may be dropped eventually by the department. With that, I'm happy to stay on for questions the committee may have.
Okay, we have one more testifier on the list, Aaron Dean. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk to you for a few minutes. I am a construction lawyer and an OSHA defense lawyer at the Minneapolis law firm of Moss and Barnett, and I'm a Bloomington resident and live just two blocks away from Representative Elkins. I want to talk to you about House File 334. I appreciate the work that Representative Frederick has done. Representative Frederick, I don't have any qualms with the vast majority of your bill. I have no opinion on the vast majority of your bill. The one thing that I do have an opinion about and that I want to share with you is Section 5. It would be a mistake to immediately make the citations public, and I want to explain why. I have handled more OSHA cases for contractors and manufacturers than any other lawyer in Minnesota. I have represented employers in over 20 states defending against OSHA citations. I live this work every single day of my career for the last 15 years or so. So I want to share with you a perspective that perhaps you have not considered or had the opportunity to hear. Minnesota OSHA is one of 22 states that has a state plan. That means that local regulators are enforcing workplace safety. The other 28 states have federal OSHA. So in the immediate five-state area, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, all are governed by federal OSHA, whereas Minnesota and Iowa have their own state plans. I heard Commissioner Robertson say that this is to promote transparency with this bill and to make Minnesota more aligned. That's just not true. I have submitted scores of FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests, to the Federal Department of Labor to try to obtain OSHA citations. You cannot get an OSHA citation issued to another employer while that case is pending. Whether once that case gets settled or once it gets resolved by trial, that is when the OSHA citation becomes public. Minnesota OSHA and the sponsorship of this section of the bill seeks to turn that reality on its head. And I want to explain why that's dangerous. And I'm going to give you three examples why that is dangerous. One,
Mr. Dean, I just want to remind you that we've got a lot of questions, so keep your example short.
I will. And the example is from last night. So I was supposed to be in trial starting on Monday on a fatality case. And in that fatality case, there were three serious level citations issued by Minnesota OSHA. The citation was issued several years ago on May 29th, 2018. Minnesota OSHA agreed last night to vacate two of the three citations. And I see that Jim Kruger, the director of Minnesota OSHA's Enforcement Division, is on this Zoom call. He will be signing the settlement agreement later today or tomorrow. If you pass this bill, not only will you make Minnesota an outlier, but think about what you will do to that company that had a fatality when Minnesota OSHA agreed to vacate two of the three citations more than 2.5 years ago when that citation was issued. They'll have to live with trying to explain themselves when ultimately Minnesota OSHA agreed to vacate two of the three citations. I'll give you another example that was just last month. It was just an injury case. I started off with a fatality that was from last night, and then I had an injury case where Mr. Kruger again signed the settlement agreement, and that case was dismissed in January, where the citation alleged a serious level citation, and it was reduced to non-serious. And that case was then dismissed by Judge Middendorf. I could go on and on with examples from November and December of 2020, where citations were vacated in their entirety with settlement agreements signed by Mr. Kruger. And yet what is being asked to have occur now is for these citations to be made immediately public. And it takes years to get these cases resolved. That is an unfair result. And it actually puts Minnesota really at risk. It puts Minnesota at risk not only in the construction community, but also in the manufacturing community, because other states don't have this rule. If you're a Fargo-based contractor and you're doing work in Fargo, you don't have your citation published right away by federal OSHA. But if you pass this law, a Moorhead-based contractor, they would have their citation published, making it very easy for the Fargo-based contractors to come in and take more work. Please think about what you're doing. This is an unintentional and inadvertent consequence, I'm sure. I'm sure that Representative Frederick had good intentions when carrying
and
this bill.
Mr. Dean, we're not going to speak to what we assume people's intentions might be. I thank you for your examples. We've got a lot of questions, so we're going to move on to questions right now. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know, I guess this might be to the bill's author. It might go to his reasoning behind bringing this bill. Are you hearing I mean, I understand that when there is a citation, it's posted for 20 days at the work site. So workers are fully aware that there's been a citation. And I just wonder, are we seeing an abnormal amount of people being injured or worse on the job? I question whether we need this bill. So if the bill's author could speak to that, please, Madam Chair.
Representative Frederick.
Madam Chair, the exact numbers of injuries across the work sites, I don't have that information in front of me. I don't know if the department would want to comment on that or not.
Commissioner Robertson.
Madam Chair, I don't have those specific statistics either at my fingertip. However, I would like to simply point out that yes, employers are required to post the information in or about where the citations were noticed. However, as the attorney indicated, it takes several years for OSHA investigations to be completed. At that time, posting the citations loses its ability to actually be a motivator for other employers to use that as a motivation to voluntarily address safety in the workplace. So we do believe that making the information available, and it's not that labor and industry have such an interest in immediately posting it. We have an interest in being able to share information with interested individuals. Oftentimes when situations occur, we have a lot of interest in the OSHA activity probably within the first 3 to 6 months of a particular investigation. We start to lose that momentum the longer it takes for the citations to be, the investigation to be fully adjudicated. We believe that we have a window of opportunity where we can encourage other employers, including the specific employer, to voluntarily address safety in the workplace. Certainly, we can get additional statistics in terms of the overall number of citations that are issued in a year time. If the committee has interest, we can provide that to you.
Follow-up, Representative Scott?
Yeah, real quickly, Madam Chair. And so I'm a person that likes transparency in government and other things, right? But I also believe that there is already a lot of transparency in the system right now. You can go online to even people that worked on the Capitol restoration and still see what citations were given out during that time. And I'm, in addition to being a person about transparency, I also believe in due process. And if you're going to just, you know, besmirch someone's reputation by putting something out there in the public realm where they haven't even been able to defend themselves, then I think that's wrong. And I don't think that this bill is needed. I won't be supporting it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, members. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to get my hand up before we adopted the amendment, so I want to speak a little bit on that. I do have concerns with that amendment that was put on there now with the bill as well. I'm just wondering if Representative Frederick could answer why he decided to use an administrative rule, which is not statute or not a law, to protect this data. An administrative rule in, I believe it's, was it 1205-0500 is a rule. The legislature has nothing to do with that. The administration can change those rules at any time and could actually open up that data, especially involving a minor, unintentionally. I'm hoping that he can go back to relook at that and revisit it and get it corrected. Unfortunately, the other day we passed a amendment dealing with the same thing on a environmental bill that I think we need to go relook at, because the administration can change rules at any time. And that's great concerning to me if we're referencing the protection of important data, especially on minors, that is not in statute, but in administrative rule. Thank you.
I actually think maybe Nathan Hopkins from Nonpartisan Research might be the best person to answer that. Mr. Hopkins, do you have an answer to Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair and members, so the A1 amendment that was adopted onto this bill earlier in committee deleted a reference in the bill to Minnesota Rules Part 1205.0500. That same language was in the DNR bill that Chair Becker-Finn carried that we heard at the last session, which was also deleted. So that administrative rule will apply to the minor data regardless of whether or not it's explicitly cited in the bill. And there's a concern that when the legislature explicitly cites to a rule that it doesn't need to explicitly cite to, courts will interpret situations as raising an ambiguity. They'll say, well, if the legislature doesn't explicitly cite to the rule here, but they do explicitly cite to the rule in these other statutes, maybe they mean that the rule doesn't apply unless they explicitly cite to it. So for that reason, because the rule applies regardless of whether or not the statute cites to it, it's best just not to cite to the rule since it applies by default. By eliminating the citation to the rule in this bill and in the previous bill, the committee hasn't made it so that that rule does not.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. That was really helpful. In reference to both the bills. The next person on the list is Representative Long.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I have two questions. My first question is for Mr. Hansen, and I'm curious what percentage of citations, if you know, are actually contested or litigated.
I'm not sure who wants to take that one.
Mr. Hanson's who I directed it to.
Okay, Mr. Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Long. I don't have that data. I don't represent contractors in the legal proceedings on there. If Mr. Dean is available, he might, as somebody who does that sort of work.
Mr. Dean, and only if you actually have the data, we can, we're looking for actual numbers here.
I do not have that data, but that would be available in the yearly FAME report that Minnesota OSHA presents to the Secretary of Labor in Washington, D.C.
All right. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My guess is that it would be a pretty small number that are actually contested. We've had some conversation about due process and the unfairness of having these citations be public. And I think it's worth members remembering that in our criminal system, when somebody is have a complaint filed against them, that is made public. The due process comes after that complaint is made public, and it does not violate due process for those criminal complaints to be made public. So my second questions are for Commissioner Robertson, and I'm wondering, what is the process that you go through to issue these citations? I would assume that these aren't done willy-nilly, that you have some thought into whom you're citing and why. And then a follow-up would be if you've had conversations with other employer organizations. My understanding is that the Association of General Contractors is neutral on the bill, and would be curious if you could confirm that.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Long. Yes, I also would imagine that it's a little bit harder than a negative review on Google. Commissioner Robertson, to Representative Long's question.
Madam Chair, yes, I'd be happy to address the representative question. I also have information regarding the number of OSHA investigations or citations that are contested. About only 15% of the citations are actually contested, and only 3% of those citations go on for litigations. In terms of the OSHA investigative process that leads to citations, basically an inspection takes place. After the on-site inspection takes place, there is a very detailed review of the entire OSHA investigation file. We have a number of processes that are internal that we provide to impacted employers. When citations are issued after the investigation is completed and the file is reviewed, appropriate citations are issued. At that time, those citations are mailed to the employer. They are also mailed to the authorized representative if the employees are represented in the workplace. At that time, then the employer have 20 days to contest any citations. If citations are contested, then employers are invited to participate in an informal conference. That informal conference allows the employer additional time to provide additional information or to give context about the actual on-site process. My apologies. Thereafter, if agreement is not reached during the informal conference, then the investigation file is then referred to the Attorney General's office for actual litigation. So I agree with your assessment, Chair, that these are not willy-nilly. The OSHA division is quite confident when citations are issued. Yes, there are additional opportunities for settlement agreement, but that does not, that should not infer that we have been presumptuous in assessing those citations to begin with.
Thank you, Commissioner Robertson. Representative Frazier, and then we'll go to the vote.
I'll be quick. Representative Long covered much of what I wanted to say, but I had one additional question. Are those settlement agreements public?
Commissioner Robertson.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer that to the OSHA Director, Jim Krueger.
Mr. Krueger, please introduce yourself and go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Krueger. I'm the Minnesota OSHA Enforcement Director here in the state of Minnesota. And in regards to the representative's questions, yes, once the settlement agreement is signed, it is available and it would be public.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Krueger. Thank you, members. Representative Frederick, any quick closing words?
I just think that it was a good discussion, and I hope that I can get everybody's support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Frederick. I renew my motion that House File 334, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Ms. Borgerding, please go ahead with the roll.
Chair Becker-Fenn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
I have 10 ayes and 7 nays.
Thank you. With that, the motion prevails and House File 334 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, everybody, for your testimony. We will move to the next bill on the agenda today, which is House File 566. It's a Representative Fisher bill. I will move that House File 566 be recommended to be referred to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Fisher, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Appreciate the opportunity to present the bill to you and the committee. First of all, I want to thank my co-author, Representative Johnson, for his support on the bill. This bill is was started last year to address the issues of accommodations and documentation practices of service animals and housing. I've got several testifiers who are with me today that can help explain the bill and touch on it, because I see that we are tight on time here. So I will turn it over, in respect to time, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Yes, thank you, Chair Fisher. First on the list, I have Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Probably the folks from the Ms. Stefani, I probably should have gone first, but whatever. I'll just say that want to thank the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association and Ms. Stefani for inviting me and Legal Aid into this process and allowing us to collaborate with them to shape this bill. I think it does strikes the absolute appropriate balance of ensuring that documentation in these situations is legitimate, because there are legitimate concerns about that, and at the same time, preserving and protecting the rights of Minnesotans with disabilities. I'll stop there and turn it over to Ms. Stefaniak.
All right, Ms. Stefaniak, please introduce yourself for the committee and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here this morning. My name is Leanna Stefaniak, and I am with At Home Apartments, which is a property management company located in the Twin Cities and also St. Cloud. Also, thank you to Mr. Elwood for his comments and his support and collaboration on this bill. As Representative Fisher mentioned, this was something that we had worked on last year, but due to COVID, it never made its way through the final process. The purpose of this bill is really to provide guidance and clarity on the required documentation needed to make a reasonable accommodation for housing policies that relate to animals and emotional support animals and service animals. Not unlike other industries that have had to deal with the fraudulent representation of service animals or emotional support animals, this has become a bigger issue in that housing sector. A couple years ago, the state addressed this issue as it related to the grocers. As I'm sure that you've seen in headlines across the country, the airlines have been dealing with the fraudulent misrepresentation of emotional support animals and service animals as well. So this bill, from a housing perspective, is trying to curtail the boutique industry that has kind of popped up with the selling of certifications and letters so people can bypass pet policies or rent or pet deposits, trying to give, landlords proper guidance as to how they can vet these requests, and then also protect the rights of those who do have bona fide disabilities under the ADA, and make sure that they're not put under unwarranted scrutiny because of the fraudulent practices of people who are trying to abuse the system. There are many websites out there where you can literally go online, answer a few questions, get a letter issued to you that says you need an emotional support animal. In some cases, they'll give you a two-for-one. They'll give you your housing letter and your airline letter for $95. And the names of these websites just by themselves beg question, certapet.com, waggypet.com. And so with this bill, we're really trying to provide guidance so landlords and residents who do need these extra steps to make sure that they can quietly enjoy the apartment in the same way as somebody else are protected and have clarity as to what they need to do move forward. It also is in complement to many similar law, bills across other jurisdictions in other states, and also mirrors some of the guidance that came out from HUD in January 2020 of last year.
All Thank you, Ms. Stefaniak. I don't have any other testifiers on the list. Members, do we have any questions? I know this is something that was vetted in previous years as well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Fisher, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a good bill. It's been vetted very well with all parties involved. I can say this, there's a huge difference between an emotional support animal and a service animal. A service animal is highly trained, and where a emotional support animal might not have any training. I was in one of my grocery stores a couple of years ago when somebody claimed, before we reclarified the service and emotional support dogs a couple of years ago, where a person had an emotional support dog instead of a service dog, but had the service dog flat, cover on it. And when they're going by the meat mart, the meat section of the grocery store, the animal jumped up, grabbed a package of steaks, and started carrying that around. The store had to throw away over $200, $200 to $300 worth of steaks because of that issue, where a trained service dog wouldn't do that. So I thank you for this, bringing this bill forward. I think it's a good common ground where we can keep the landlords protected from those who abuse the system, and let the people who actually need it have the support they need. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have been in the legislature long enough to know that I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of telling stories about animals. But I thank you, Representative Johnson, for your comments. Representative Fisher, any closing words?
This is a great bill, great support between all parties. I recommend a yes vote. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Fisher. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 566 be recommended to be referred to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Holland.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And then Representative Scott, I couldn't quite hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Aye.
You have 17 ayes.
Thank you, Ms. Borgerding, for clarifying that vote. With that, the motion prevails and House File 566 is on its way to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you to the testifiers and to Representative Fisher. We do have one last bill today. It is House File 418. It is a Representative Hollins bill. Representative Hollins, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move that HF 418 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
All right, great. We have the bill before us. I do understand that you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move that author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Hollins moves the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that she would like. Members, do you have any questions to the author's amendment? All right, with that, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing about this bill. It's a bill to protect elder homeowners in tax forfeiture and other groups of homeowners who are in jeopardy of losing their home because of what is known as equity stripping. That is a scam where individuals take advantage of people who are in very difficult situations and remove the equity from their home. What this bill seeks to do is clarify the 2004 statute, which was passed to eradicate the scam against homeowners. And the 2004 bill was specifically eradicated it from mortgage foreclosures. And we want to also protect homeowners trying to avoid tax forfeiture or foreclosure by homeowners associations for non-payment of association dues. So just for a little bit of history, in the early 2000s, when, like now, home values and homeowner equity was rising fast, while a segment of Minnesotans were struggling financially, a predatory scam was devised where actors posing as foreclosure rescue companies, in quotations, promised to save people's homes. Under the equity stripping scheme, the homeowner deeds the property to the scammer, who in turn promises to sell it back on contract for deed or to enter into a rental situation. The deal that's agreed to by these desperate homeowners was set up to fail, and when it does, the homeowner under contract for deed was out of a home and out of all their equity in 60 days of default, and the re-enter or the renter could be evicted in as little as 8 days. The bipartisan law passed in 2004 and it tamped out this scam for mortgage foreclosures. And in 2007, we tweaked it to broaden its coverage to other homeowners, including those subject to tax forfeiture. Unfortunately, the 2007 language was a little ambiguous, and a 2020 district court ruled that the same scam that is illegal and unconscionable if perpetrated against a homeowner in mortgage foreclosure could be perpetrated with impunity against a homeowner in tax forfeiture. So really, the bulk of this bill is to tighten the language up in Chapter 325 to provide these protections apply equally in any circumstances where homeowners can lose their home, whether through mortgage foreclosure, tax forfeiture, or foreclosure by a homeowners association for non-payment of dues. The main changes are, they're pretty repetitive. It's clear that these protections are not limited just to foreclosure situations. And there is a section of the bill that attempts to codify the practices of Hennepin County, which as a matter of policy, return the deed or certificate to the homeowner, even if the scammer is paying off the back taxes owed. I would also like to note that there are a number of stakeholders who have been working on this bill, and it's been vetted by them, and they are strongly in favor of it. And I have several testifiers here today to answer any questions that folks might have.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. I will note we got permission to go a couple minutes past 10 o'clock. But we will go ahead with your testifiers on each of them, if they could keep their testimony focused to just a couple minutes. Mr. Elwood, you are first on my list.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Representative Hollins really explained the whole bill. We're happy to answer some questions. And I just want to follow up on Representative Hollins' appreciation for the stakeholders and name them. I'd like to thank the Minnesota Bankers Association and the Minnesota Credit Union Network, the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, the Minnesota Realtors, the Minnesota Land Title Association, the Minnesota State Bar Association, and Mr. Dunleavy is on Zoom. He's from the real property section. He was extremely helpful in helping us with the amendment and making sure that all the T's were crossed and the I's dotted, and also the Community Association Institute, and all of them provided some input and many of their suggestions are reflected in the underlying bill and the amendment. I'll stop there, and thank you very much. Happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Next on the list, I have Brittany McCormick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brittany McCormick. I'm a staff attorney at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, and I'll keep my comments very short. We see these clients come to us that are, you know, post-equity stripping. And when we look at the statute, we were not 100% sure that it applied to tax forfeiture. So that's the reason we're fixing it. There were spots in the statute where it did apply and spots where it was more ambiguous that it only applied to foreclosures. So that's what we're accomplishing with this fix. It'll help a lot of people. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. McCormick. And it was helpful to hear, you know, really the heart of the bill is keeping people in their homes. And I think that that's important. So thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Jeff Strand. I'm not sure if you were here to testify or just to be available for questions.
Chair, I'm here from Hennepin County Resident Real Estate Services as a tax administrator to answer questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strand. That is the end of my list of testifiers. We'll get to member questions or discussion. Representative Farr.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Hollings, for bringing this. So having spent the last couple of decades in the business of giving out mortgages, I just want to say thank you for this bill. I think it's a great bill, stopping some predatory behaviors going on out there and protecting the consumer. So in the essence of time, I'll keep it short, but thank you for the bill. I'm fully supportive of it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Farr. Any other member questions? Representative Hollins, any closing comments?
I would just like to thank all the testifiers and the folks who worked really hard on this language, and I would encourage all of you to vote yes and support this very important legislation. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 418, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feiss.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen. Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen. Okay, there's 16 ayes.
Right, thank you. With 16 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails, and House File 418, as amended, is on its way to the general register. Thank you, members, for the discussion today. Our next hearing will be Tuesday. That agenda has already been posted, so would encourage folks to take a look at that now and not wait till the last minute. We'll have another full week ahead of us. Thank you to all of our testifiers and everyone who had bills today. It's been a productive week for our committee. So thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.